Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, Reel 9. Now, what happened after you'd been awarded your wings in January 45? I mean, what about the trip? Oh, was there anything else before you left? Or?
Well, very quickly then, one got one's wings, and you filed up to get your wings in the order in which you had passed the examinations. And I remember that of the, hundreds of us, I suppose, who got our wings that day, I was 21 in the queue, which surprised these great American friends of ours, Van Spankrens, because I'd asked my friend Derek Stockton, and I had asked them to take a photograph of us getting our wings, and because Van Spankren wasn't ready for me to go up so quickly as the 21st person to get their wings, he was rather caught without his camera in his hand, and so I did get a photograph, but it was a fairly long distance one. Anyway, I passed out the 21st out of the, however many it was, which pleased me very much, because that was a combination of both flying and ground school subjects. And then we had a big party that night where we entertained these American friends at a formal, sort of quite formal dinner, to which we had been subscribing all the time we'd been in Falcon Field. And so immediately,
this was a guest night.
Yeah, but not at the airfield, but in a plush hotel back in Phoenix. And but the very next morning, we had to catch the train for to go back to Canada. So we didn't have much time to rest on our laurels, as you might say, or boast about it. We were on the train on the way back, and we went back 5 days in a train again.
Anything about the journey? Very
long train journey, but quite comfortable, because we had very good accommodation, you know, sleeping accommodation and so on, bunks. And then we got back to Moncton, New Brunswick, and had another wait there. I don't think it was many weeks before we were drafted onto a troop ship, which was, in this case, the Louis Pasteur.
Now, so you were there, January to February, or not even that?
Let's say the whole of January, rest of January.
Did you have was anything at all happening, or was this just purely a period of waiting?
I can't remember anything happening other than a period of waiting. I suppose we were kept busy to doing something, but I can't remember what it was. It kept from marching around the place, as usual, but I can't remember any formal instructions or... Which is a pity, because we should have been taught how to behave as officers, but I don't remember anything like that happening. At some stage we were told how to behave in the mess, which was when you get to the door of the mess, you come to attention, rather like going into church, I suppose. You come to attention before you go into the mess, and we were advised to keep a very low profile when we first went into a officer's mess. In other words, to creep into a corner and act fairly quietly and not to behave like a gentleman, I suppose. But that's pretty well all the instruction we got on being an officer, which I thought was pretty poor, really. Anyway, we got onto this troop ship.
It's the Louis Pasteur.
The Louis Pasteur, which also had a flat bottom and rolled like mad. But I don't really remember the accommodation we had, but it was quite not a bit like coming over the other way. So it was fairly comfortable, and the food was quite good again. Two meals a day, I'm pretty sure. And the only thing I can remember, two things I can remember about the troop ship, again, another 7 days, was one that we found that we could got around a member of the ship's crew. And we used to play a lot of games with a heavy handball, what do you call them, a medicine ball, I suppose. And we used to fling this medicine ball around at each other. And when the ship was rolling, if you got uphill and were able to propel the medicine ball downhill, you got the most terrific velocity. and power behind the throw, and that was great fun because you fairly floored the chef you had aimed the ball at. But I suppose it kept us very fit and gave us something to do. And I remember doing a lot of that.
Were you travelling in convoy?
I don't remember, so there can't have been a convoy, or it would have been very noticeable. I think, again, we relied on the speed of the ship to get us through once we got outside the sort of 3 mile limit. We were on our own, and I don't remember seeing any other ships, certainly not in convoy. But the other thing we discovered was that we discovered a bathroom in one of the corridors, and we discovered that in this corridor there was a bathroom, and which had salt water baths. So every day, without any authority whatsoever, we managed to get a bath some part of the day. Now that was absolute luxury, and somebody scrounged a bar of salt water soap, so that there was something that lathered in the salt water. And we thought that was a great achievement. So one after another, we used to, about perhaps half a dozen or eight of us, the same old gang, we all creep off one at a time and have this bath, unbeknown, we hoped, to the ship's authorities. I don't know whose bathroom it was, but we certainly made very good use of it. So that was a fairly uneventful journey back.
Now, what happened when you got... this February you got back, I presume?
Yes, I think it must have been February. Well, we went to a... I think we were taken by train to... some place in Yorkshire. Harrogate in Yorkshire, where we were... we had to hand in all our airman's type equipment, which we had no more use for. And we hung on to things like our... our tinted glasses, sunglasses, which we found very useful to hang on to, and one or two other things that we'd been issued with, which we were able to make use of afterwards. So we only had a few days, perhaps 7 days, in 7 to 10 days in Harrogate, and then we got sent on disembarkation leave, and that was the leave in which you had to try and get your uniform. Officer's uniform. You could have bought one in Canada, but it was an off-the-shelf job, and I wanted to have mine made for me, which I did back at home.
You got a grant for that, I presume?
We got a grant.
Did it cover the cost?
Pretty well, yes, pretty well.
So where would you go to? Where did you use to?
Well, I went to a very well established bespoke tailor firm in Exeter, which is where I lived and where my parents lived, so that's where I went back home to. And during my leave, and I suppose it must have been 14 days leave, I managed to persuade them to hurry up and produce me a uniform, which they did. So that was the...
Did you buy the kit to go with it? Because, you know, there's a lot of paraphernalia officers, certainly in the army, can buy. Now, this is the RAF, I understand, but did you have other stuff you'd buy?
I don't remember buying any other stuff. You know, yeah, I think what you're talking about is a bedroll and all that sort of thing that army officers...
They have a variety of paraphernalia, yes, but you didn't buy that. You don't need any of that.
I don't think we had any of that. No, I think it was just a uniform. And because all the flying gear we had... It all got issued to us out of stores. We didn't have to buy it. So I had 14 days leave at home, and then the long-awaited, or seemingly long-awaited, letter arrived posting me to the next airfield, and that was a posting from home to. The advanced flying unit at Calverley. I can't remember the name of the unit.
Calverley,
Calverley.
Where's that?
Calverley. It's between Chester and Crewe.
So Cheshire.
Yep.
And you don't know which number. They can perhaps look it up.
Well, I can look it up in my logbook, but I don't know whether it's necessary.
Which one?
Number 11. I see it signed by the CEO of Wing Commander. Number 11 brackets P. It's a pilot, I suppose.
And you went there when, about?
I went there in, it must have been in
February or March, I presume, but
1945. The 18th of April of the...
So April you started there?
Started there, yes. 18th of April. And we flew Harvards again for quite a while.
Now, what were you doing at what were you doing there that was different at the advanced flying unit?
Well, the same sort of exercises. I've got to look up what they call them. The normal flying terms of climbing and gliding down and steep turns and approach and landing, going around again, spinning, slide slipping, steep turns, instrument flying, low flying, taking off and landing out of wind, forced landings, imaginary forced landings. We started, I think, again doing formation flying.
So basically, it's just a continuation.
Yes, continuation of it, but completely different territory you're flying over. The airfields in all the airfields in England were very carefully camouflaged, so you sometimes had great difficulty in recognising the airfield that you'd taken off from.
No, how were they camouflaged? Because we've not talked about this with many people.
Well, the runways were not just strips of concrete. They were covered with some sort of asphalt and tippings to give them a colour. So that you've got a hedge running up to the side of the runway, let's say, and the hedge would be continued across the runway in black colour. So that when you looked back at the airfield, you didn't see a nice long stretch of white, shiny white concrete to land on. It was different coloured, so that it didn't stand out. And you had to really look for it. But you were taught how to spot an airfield by its... Each airfield had a signals area, which is a white square, beside the runway, but usually beside the control tower, and in it was the signals for which was the runway in use, which way you are landing, and it had a windsock in it, so you could check whether the wind was up and down the runway or right across the runway, which it sometimes was, which made landing a little bit more difficult. But the advanced flying unit was to develop. To fly a different sort of aircraft, and they're coming to the Hurricane, didn't just a moment, and to get used to flying over territory other than a desert and a socking great town, which was well lit up in America every night.
So basically, you were doing Harvard was a continuation, yes, and getting used to flying about and finding your way about.
Yep, exactly. But we expected only to do one advanced flying unit. In fact, I did two, but on this particular one at Calverley, the excitement was that they had Hurricanes.
So when did you start flying them?
And the Hurricane, I'm just looking in my logbook now, on the 25th of May.
Now, well, before then you have VE Day then. Yes. What do you remember of VE Day, and how did you feel yourself, because in a way you've been caught on the hop. I mean, I don't know whether you wanted to be in action or not. How did you feel about VE Day, and then we'll perhaps talk about any celebrations, because however you felt, I'm sure there were celebrations. How did you feel about in a way thwarted, or did you think about the Far East, or what did you think about?
Well, all those things really, because we thought, because of the day, our training would, A, it might stop altogether, which I suppose for some people it did. And if we went on training, then we obviously were being trained for the Far East or some other emergency. I'm a little bit disappointed that after all that effort and training and so on, and getting into the onto flying a Hurricane, and I still had hopes for flying a Spitfire, all this was thwarted by somebody else managing to finish the war without us. But they did still continue the training.
Was part of you relieved? Because, I mean, I know you can want something, you can also be a bit scared of it if it actually comes to fruition. I mean, was any part of you relieved that you weren't going to have to...
Well, I suppose a big chunk of me was relieved, because I had thoughts from my parents, who had already lost their number one son. My brother Peter had been killed back in 43. I hope I mentioned that earlier on. And they must have been much relieved that I managed to escape getting into combat by then. But I still felt a bit peeved that I'd, I can't put it more strongly than that, just a bit peeved that I had spent all that time training for something which I was not going to be able to now to test out.
I don't think you did mention your brother. I mean, I may be wrong, because it's quite a while since I've seen you. Can we talk a bit about the impact the death of your brother had on you and on your parents, without wishing to upset you, because that's obvious.
Well, if I failed to mention it, I'm very sorry, because it was a very important part of my existence back in June, July 1943, when I was in fact at the university at Oxford on the University Air Squadron course, and my brother was in the airborne division in glider-borne troops. He was in the 2nd Battalion of the South Staffordshire Regiment, and they got landed in at Sicily, and they got were being towed by American tug pilots, who I later discovered the tug pilots were very badly trained. I got a feeling I did mention this earlier on, because the tug pilots got very scared at the anti-aircraft that was being thrown up at them, and they released the gliders 10 miles out short of Sicily. And so the majority of the gliders that my brother's unit were in crashed into the sea, and very, very few of them got onto to the shore, were able to swim ashore. And my brother was therefore drowned because his glider crashed in the sea, and I think all but one of the occupants of that aircraft were drowned. The one who did got ashore 16 hours after the plane had crashed. So he was in the water for 16 hours before being found on the shore in an exhausted condition, of course. But it was he who was able to give an account of the last few moments of the glider. So my brother was killed in action on the invasion of Sicily, which upset everybody in the family terribly, and my parents in particular, because he was such a brilliant young man. Brilliant scholar, brilliant athlete, and so on. So you can you appreciate how they must have felt when VE Day came along, and I had not been put into a position of great danger, other than the usual danger of just flying an aeroplane. But so they must have been very, very, very relieved, and I was caught up in a mixture of relief and disappointment, as I say, of being peeved at the possibility of my joining a squadron. And joining a squadron was then the great objective. You know, was I going to be too late, and never ever going to join a squadron.
That was what you dreamed of, joining a squadron. Yes, well, more than going into action then, in a sense.
Yes, the camaraderie which would have were a result of joining an elite squadron of a comparatively few people. And hopefully being able to apply some of the things I had learned in flying an aeroplane, which is the whole reason we joined up in the beginning. But I also ought to mention that whilst I was at Oxford, my brother wrote me an encouraging letter. A letter of, he was a very, very talented bloke, obviously, and he wrote this wonderful letter to encourage me to enjoy life as much as I could, how to do it, and not care whose money I spent in doing it, which was his philosophy of life, but to get the most out of everything one did. And I treasured this letter for many years, and eventually I loaned it to my nephew, who had just gone to join the RAF in peacetime, the one who in fact finished up as a group captain, which is very, very creditable. But I loaned it to him to encourage him, and between us, I say that on purpose because I'm quite sure he lost it and he's quite sure I lost it, the letter got lost forever. And I mentioned this, some 10 or 15 years ago to my son, and how sorry I was that I wasn't able to show him the letter, and what an impact it had had on me when I read it and treasured it. And he said, well, why don't you answer it now? And in my memoirs, I have answered from memory this letter, which I think is a great thing to have been done. And I say in the letter, this is the letter I would have written to you, Pete, had I been polite enough to respond to your letter, which I'm sure I would have done. But unfortunately, the letter got lost, so I'll do it from memory, which I did. And I find it still quite emotional to read my letter back to him. The letter I've circulated to my son and one or two others. But yes, so going back to this date in April, May 1945, I just felt peeved that if I'd only been 6 months earlier along the line, might have got over this hurdle and actually achieved something. But however, this was not to be. But I was more concerned then with continuing the training.
Now, you did. Now, tell me about the Hurricane. Then, what was your first... Which Hurricane was it, by the way?
It was a Hurricane 2C.
Now, could you give us I know we can go and look at one, probably, but can you give us a sort of pen picture of the Hurricane and its faults, its strengths and weaknesses as you saw it, the 2C?
Yes, right. Stop me when... if I continue too long about this. But when you got to Calverley and discovered that they'd got hurricanes, this was an enormous step. So we knew that for the first time we were going to be flying an aeroplane, which we'd never had dual in before. And to look at these hurricanes, they were bigger and more powerful and more noisy and more everything. And they had many more gadgets inside the cockpit. But one of the big features about this particular advanced flying unit was that we had a particularly good flight commander. I can't remember his name, although it's probably in my logbook, because he didn't do any flying while I was there. He managed to avoid, as quite a number of flight commanders later on discovered, didn't actually bother to fly anymore. They'd obviously done their bit, thought they had. But he was an extremely good instructor in as much as he could convey in an armchair exactly how he felt when he flew the Hurricane. And I remember him saying, the Hurricane is the easiest aeroplane in the RAF to land. He said, you bring it in at the approved speed of 70 or 80 miles an hour, or knots or whatever it was in those days, knots I suppose, and you bring it over the fence with a little bit of throttle just to keep the proper flying speed, and you ease the stick back as you get close to the ground, and you get it into the landing position, otherwise the tail down, the nose up, and when it's just about ready to stall, you chop the throttle, you pull the throttle right back, and it will sit down on all three wheels at the same time, which is the absolute, perfect landing. And he said, when you drop the throttle, when you pull the throttle back, this is his words, and I remember them still, the thing will drop down like a brick-built shithouse. And that's exactly what happened. You've brought the plane down and got it into the landing attitude, with the nose up slightly. You've dropped the throttle and it just settled down on the ground. And because it was a fairly heavy airplane, and with the two front wheels, the two wheels, fairly widely spread, it didn't bounce or rock about or throw you back in the air, which is the thing you don't want to happen. And it trundled down the runway without any bother at all. And it did trundle because we hadn't landed on concrete runways before. It had always been in the sand in Arizona. So it made an unaccustomed, funny noise when it trundled along at 70 or 80 miles an hour. And I well remember, because it being April, May, and a beautiful spring, there were lots of hares on the airfield, and they would gallop along beside you as you trundle down the runway, and it was quite extraordinary to be accompanied by one or two hares who obviously just quite happy bouncing along the runway alongside these funny aeroplane things. So one's attention was distracted fairly quickly from the landing, and it was such a gentle, kind aeroplane, it stayed on the runway quite happily, and I was very lucky because I didn't for a long time have to make any landing where the wind was not fairly well directly down the runway, so I had no crosswind to worry about. But what I did have, I remember again, now I started talking about it, was the first solo. You just get yourself in a position so that you've done enough in the harbour to convince the instructor that you're ready to go on to a hurricane. You've passed the necessary test of being blindfolded in the cockpit and being able to reach out and touch the correct instrument and the correct control, even though you can't see it. So that's cockpit familiarisation. So you've done all that.
To my first solo.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, that's right. I remember the point I was trying to make. You normally, when you fly, always you do a left-hand circuit. In other words, your airfield's on your left. So you're looking over the throttles all the time. And it's quite foreign, it's quite funny to have to do a right-hand circuit. Now, this particular airfield, the group captain in control of this particular place, Keeble, Calverley, said that every Tuesday and Thursdays you will do a right-hand circuit. And it so happened that it was either a Tuesday or a Thursday that I did my first solo. So for the first time in a new aeroplane, I was going to have to do a right-hand circuit, which made it, it's like going into your garage at home from a different direction to which you normally go into. It's not difficult, it's not impossible, but it's wrong, it's the wrong-handed, and it makes it a little bit more difficult.